And so for me, a lot of the work that I do today is driven based on this fact that I don't want other young people to experience that. I don't want other young Latinos that are in classrooms to feel like they don't belong. I don't want them to feel like they're different in any way, shape, or form. And I want them to understand that their cultural inheritance, that is all valuable and will make the difference in the long term.
This is Associations Thrive, the podcast celebrating successful associations and their leaders. I'm your host, Joanna Pineda, CEO and Chief Troublemaker at Matrix Group International. Listen in as top association executives tell all, revealing the creative and innovative ways they're increasing membership, generating revenue, nurturing engagement, and reimagining their organizations. By the way, if you've launched a new initiative, created new member services, or updated your governance structure and are seeing great results, I want to hear your story and so do my listeners. I'd love to have you as a guest. Go to podcast.matrixgroup.net and apply to be on Associations Thrive. Now let's dive into this week's show. Today, I'm speaking with Edgar Palacios, founder and CEO of the Latinx Education Collaborative, or LEC. Edgar, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Joanna, for having me on.
Edgar, tell us about LEC.
Yes, the LEC is a nonprofit organization that's working on really improving the educational outcomes and experiences of Latino youth in our community. We are working directly with Latino educators, Latino parents and caregivers, Latino students themselves, and allies to ensure that we're building the conditions that are necessary to advance Latino youth. And so part of our work is to build a strong community of Latino educators, ensure that we're adding new folks into that community and that we're retaining those folks in classrooms across the country and in Kansas City. Two, making sure that parents and caregivers in our community have access to better navigate educational systems and build relationships with their teachers and school leaders. And then with students themselves working on helping strengthen their identity and their connection to Latino community.
Now, Edgar, what's the origin story behind LEC? Like, why did someone, you, decide that LEC was needed?
I had an incredible opportunity to travel across this country and see different school models through a local foundation here in Kansas City. I ended up in places like Anaheim, California, and Denver, Colorado, and Houston, Texas. And I saw many schools that had a large Latino student population, but very few Latino adults in classrooms in the buildings and whatnot. And so I began to ask questions. In fact, it was in Houston when I walked into a school that was 99.9% Latino students, but did not have any educators of color in the building. And so I remember during the panel discussion, I raised my hand. I was a little shaky, a little nervous. And I asked, why is it that in a place like Houston, Texas, we're not seeing any educators of color in this building when students are primarily Latino? And the response that I got from the principal was twofold. First and foremost, we go out into the community, we try to find folks that are reflective of the students we serve, but Houston's a competitive environment. It is what it is. And I was like, okay.
So they couldn't find them.
Couldn't find them, yes. And then the second part of the response was, listen, we can teach anybody to teach, but they have to be a good culture fit. And to me, that felt like a dog whistle. Like, what do we mean by culture fit? Like, whose culture are we talking about? If you can teach anybody to teach, why isn't it that we're teaching more Black and Brown folks to be teachers and educators? And so that led me down a path, right? And my initial idea was, I'm going to go ahead and meet every Latino educator across the country and put their names in a spreadsheet. And then the next time somebody tells me that they can't find any, I'm going to say, here's the list and here you go. That was a simple solution to a very complicated and complex problem, and one that I've been pursuing every day since that time in 2016. And so we got our official 501c3 status. And at the end of 2018, we also launched a 501c4 political organization called Revolución Educativa to ensure that we were advocating for the policies and issues that we thought would help improve these outcomes. And so it's been an interesting experience thus far, but the idea behind it was Latino representation matters. We know that when young people see themselves reflected in the teachers that serve them, they have better educational outcomes and experiences. And so we're in pursuit of that idea, and it's been an incredible journey.
And Edgar, there's research that supports the idea that representation matters, that if I see people like me, I have better educational outcomes.
Absolutely. It's well documented at this point through literature reviews, through different research projects across the country with different researchers, of course. And so there's an idea and meaningful data that demonstrate that when a young person sees themselves or sees themselves reflected by an adult, there's an immediate connection that's formed. There is an interest that is developed. There is a feeling of belonging that is created. And that allows that student to better engage with their educational experience and environment, right? We hear a lot of anecdotal stories of Latino educators who are often the only ones in their building, maybe sometimes in their district. And during lunchtime or during after school or before school hours, they will have a group of Latino students that are coming to them, hanging out with them, being in their classroom, because that's where they feel the most safest, the most comfortable, and that's where they're building the relationship. It's a beautiful thing, except for, you know, sometimes this is outside of the scope of the teacher's work, right? So they're taking on additional responsibilities. If that teacher also happens to be bilingual, they become the chief Latino officer, which means in addition to doing the instruction and the planning and all the other stuff that comes along with being a teacher, they are now also the interpreter, they're the translator, they are the cultural broker for students.
The teacher that all the parents go to.
Absolutely. And so it can become a really time-consuming and energy-consuming job.
Potentially a burden for them, right? That they didn't sign up for it.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, you know, I'm thinking back to my high school years. The high school that I went to in San Francisco was 60% non-white. But Edgar, I think every teacher was white that I can remember. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. The most recent data that I've seen is that somewhere between 89 to 90% of teachers in this country are going to be white women. Across the country, only 2% of educators identify as Latino. In Kansas City, where we're based, that number is closer to 1%. And that isn't reflective of the student population. We're seeing a huge increase in Latino student population. Last I checked, 25% of all students in K-12 public education are Latino. That number is going to continue to grow exponentially over the next 10 to 15 years. And so we have a gap that is increasing, right? We don't have the same amount of teachers that are coming into the workforce that are Latino compared to the students that are showing up. And so we are trying to bridge that gap. We understand that this problem is bigger than also just, you know, certification issues or schooling. It's also about the fact that there are a lot of schools and school systems that are not prepared for the fact that their school is diverse. They don't have the cultural competency, the cultural knowledge, the nuance that is needed to create that kind of experience. And so that often can prevent Latino educators from being successful long term. They burn out. They get tired of fighting systems. They get tired of having to be the Latino or the Hispanic teacher. And so we're trying to make sure that we build a world where, one, every school has a Latino teacher, but two, like, it's more than one, right? Like, you're building a community and that people are seeing the value of our community in education systems.
I listened to a podcast by Harvard Business Review that said, when you have at least 4 or 5 women or people of color on a board or in a workforce, that's when you start to see change. When they're the only one, somehow it doesn't have the same impact that we all hope, right? That when we talk about diversity matters, that you have a diversity of opinion, of perspectives, it's not able to really be represented until there's a little bit of a cohort, so that then there's probably strength in numbers.
Absolutely. In fact, as part of my employment history, my work history, I spent 3 years at a local organization in Kansas City called Central Exchange. And it was actually a women's professional development organization. And so it was an association, a membership association. We had roughly 1,000+ members, and we did some advocacy work. And one thing that we learned, that the magic number was 3. If you had 3 women on a corporate board, you were going to see an increase in how many women were going to rise up the ranks in the actual company. You're going to see an increase in profitability. You're going to see an increase in investment in other women-owned businesses. And so we had a whole program and advocacy agenda around this idea of increasing gender diversity on corporate boards, because it had a trickle-down effect. And so that's an idea, a foundational idea that drives the work that we do with the LEC. How do we make sure that it isn't just one? Although a lot of times one is revolutionary in itself.
One already makes a difference.
It already makes a difference. But how do we ensure that that one sticks around? Because likely, statistically, they're not going to make it past their third year of teaching. And then two, how do we build a community of support around them so they feel like they have a place that they can go and commiserate, share resources, build relationships, and deepen their roots within the profession?
So Edgar, is that part of what you do, that even if I am the only Latino teacher at a Kansas City high school, that somehow within LEC, I also find a community so I don't feel so alone? Is that part of what you do?
Yeah, that's definitely part of the goal, right? We want to make sure that if you're not receiving the love and support in your classroom or in your school building, that you're finding it within our organization. Maybe that school is not the ideal school for you. Maybe there are other schools that are better for you and for your personality and for your specific goals. And so we want to ensure that there is a place that is also preventing people from exiting the profession. We want to be the first person that you talk to when you have any questions around whether you want to exit the profession or not. We want you to feel like you're also not crazy. And I think that that's actually one of the most important things that we do as an organization, as a community. We affirm this idea that when you're the only one in a building or you're part of a few, we affirm the experiences that you're seeing. We are constantly navigating racist systems. We're constantly navigating microaggressions. We're constantly navigating all the narrative in the society currently around Latinos and immigration and all these other things that are associated. And so it can make you feel a little crazy when you're experiencing that by yourself. When you go to a group or a convening of ours, or you know, you meet with one of our team members, they're going to tell you that you're not the only person experiencing that. And they're going to connect you to other folks that will help, again, validate you, but also say, hey, here's how I move through it.
Right.
Here's how we can move through it together. And that relationship building, that bonding, I think is critical in the retention of educators and in the retention of the people that we care about the most.
Edgar, I got a zillion more questions about LEC, but before I continue asking those questions, I want to talk to you about your journey. So how'd you get to become founder and CEO? It's one thing to say there's a need, but it's another thing to say, I'm going to start an organization, do the paperwork, and get this thing funded and set up the structure to do this.
I will say that I just started in the pursuit of an idea. I think in Houston, that was a transformative moment for me because it also agitated me. It fired me up in a way that I didn't know that I could get fired up about this issue. I'm not an educator by trade. If anything, I've been a nonprofit professional for the majority of my career. And this idea kept gnawing at me. Like, why is it that us as a community, that we're not better represented in schools? It didn't make sense. And it definitely didn't make sense in a place like Houston, Texas. I understood, like, if it was a place like maybe St. Louis, Missouri, or maybe like Nashville, Tennessee, I'm making some assumptions there, but I would have understood, like, yeah, maybe there's not a lot of Latinos here and it is what it is, right? In Houston, that didn't make sense to me. And so what I learned was, of all the barriers that prevent young people from going into the profession, I learned about teacher shortages. I learned about identity issues, right? Who is Latino? Who isn't Latino? How do people identify how they want to connect, how they do not want to connect? All the historical kind of knowledge that comes along with that. And it has been just a journey, right? It is in pursuit of this idea that Latinos deserve to be in school buildings and they deserve to be part of the decision making in schools. They deserve to be a part of those conversations. And it's critical for our young people. Our young people are not going to see upward mobility, more opportunities to succeed, if they don't have folks who understand where they're coming from.
Who can help them navigate the educational system, which in this country is really key to upward mobility.
Absolutely. I still believe that education is the great, like, equalizer in our country. Now, that may be shifting and changing, but at the moment, I still definitely believe that education is the thing. And that's what my parents taught me too, right? That is a value that they instilled in me. And I think that that is a value that many Latinos across the country, if not many just folks across the country, believe in, right? Education is a key to achieving that upward mobility and to be a part of prosperity, right? Inclusive prosperity. And so that drives me. that continues to motivate me. I have found people along the way who agree, who also have broadened the vision and brought new ideas to how we do this better. And when you meet an educator who is passionate about their work, who is passionate about their why, and who consistently shows up for Latino students, if not all students, then our work becomes less difficult. I won't say that it isn't difficult, but the reality is the people doing the hardest work are the people that are in classrooms every day, fighting these battles and fighting all these other issues that prevent young people from being as successful as they can be.
Edgar, how long have you been at this?
This was an idea that I had in 2016. We got our nonprofit status at the end of 2018. We've been through a pandemic. We've been through the racial reckoning of this decade. We're currently in a really weird political environment. So it's been since 2016, and I'm going on 10 years of pursuing this idea, and then close to, what, 7, 8 years of actually in existence. It's also funny for me to say that, like, we started in 2018 because our funding didn't really show up initially until like the end of 2019. And so while the official dates are there, when we can start actually moving the work forward, it takes a longer time than what the paperwork says.
Edgar, I had Urich Shannon on from the Surge Institute of Chicago, and you're an award winner from the Surge Institute. Tell us about that. I think this is a huge honor.
Yes, I agree. I am an OG alumni award winner from Surge. I was part of the Surge Academies program in Kansas City in 2019.
And tell my listeners what the Surge Institute is.
The Surge Institute is an organization that is building leadership for Black and Brown leaders in education. And so we were fortunate to be one of the cities that brought the program into its community. And really, it's a transformational experience. It isn't about how you lead. It isn't about all the technicalities that your traditional leadership programs would talk about. It's really about why you lead and how do you actually navigate the world as a leader, as a person of color in this country. And so there's a lot of raw, honest conversations about what we can expect out in the real world, so to speak. And also, it's a network of folks that are experiencing similar issues with funding, with governance, with leading people, and trying to retain your identity and your authenticity in a world that often requires you to kind of put it to the side. And I think that that's what's been really powerful about my involvement with Surge. It is this sustaining belief that it is okay to be who you are. It is okay to lean into your gifts and to show up in a world that often may not want you to show up the way that you are. And I think that that's been a really powerful learning. And it's a lesson that continues to evolve over the years. And so my engagement with Surge continues to be strong. It's one of the first organizations that I've, without hesitation, continue to support in time, talent, and treasure. And I think that that's critically important because I want other folks to be able to experience what I experienced, because it's made a meaningful difference in my life and in the way that I think about leadership, but also in the way that I pursue our work.
Love that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Hey, let's turn to LEC. You've got a bunch of programs. You have Expresión, you've got Evolución, you've got your Futuros program, and the Latinx Educator Awards.
Yes.
What do we start with? You want to start with Expresión?
Let's definitely start with Expresión. So Expresión is an idea that started alongside our partners with Storytellers for Change that is ran by Luis Ortega. The idea is that storytelling is a function of advocacy. And our goal was to create a space where Latino educators could, one, reckon with their identities, reckon with their stories, but be able to emerge from the program being able to tell a powerful story about who they are, what drives them, and how they connect to others. And that is such a powerful story to tell to young people. When you have a confident Latino educator who's not afraid of their background, who's not afraid of their identity, and they are in front of a Latino student, it makes a world of a difference. And so I think we are on our 5th cohort at the moment of storytellers. The stories are powerful. They are small, like nuggets into our community, small windows into our community as well. And what I've really appreciated about the program itself is the commonalities, the common threads amongst all of our stories, and how we continue to persist in spite of the barriers that we may face. And so it's been a really powerful program and experience, and I'm looking forward to continuing to partner with Storytellers for Change for years to come to make sure that we have more educators who understand public narrative and the importance of how it builds a different world for our young people.
Man, talk about a skill for your life. Being able to make a point or change a heart or change a mind through stories. I mean, that's useful everywhere. But to be confident in your storytelling and powerful in your storytelling, man, I love this.
It's important, right? I think all stories are valuable and all stories have lessons that can be shared. And to me, in this moment, it humanizes us. There are collective human experiences that we all share, regardless of our race, regardless of our class, regardless of any other identity marker. And it is in stories where we can see each other as humans and maybe have a different way of being with each other. And so, yeah, absolutely love it.
Have you been through the program?
I have not been through the program myself. One day I may do it outside of the organization because Storytellers for Change has their own cohorts outside of it.
Is there a part of your leadership value system that you think is deeply rooted in your Latino identity?
Absolutely.
Would you share something?
Yeah, absolutely. I was born in Miami, Florida. My parents are immigrants. They came to this country from Nicaragua in the early 80s. I was born a few years later. One thing that I've recognized and realized is that I grew up in a community that was strong in its Latino identity. We had people from across Central and South America, across the Caribbean, and I was exposed to that as a kid. You know, I grew up with that as my foundation. It wasn't rare for me to see Latinos in positions of power, or influence, or decision-making. It wasn't rare for me to see Latino educators who also spoke Spanish. Like, that was just part of the environment. I could go to a couple of different restaurants and have Nicaraguan food, right? Like, I could do all these things. When we moved from Miami, Florida to Spokane, Washington, when I was becoming a sixth grader, that was a tough experience for me. One, I did not know that the world wasn't like Miami. I didn't know that Miami was a rare place in this country. And Spokane taught me that, you know, I just learned a lot. I learned about segregation. I learned about racism. I learned about discrimination. And it all happened, right? And so I spent 3 years in Spokane, like really reckoning with this fact that I was different, that I wasn't part of the majority. There was a lot of questions about how I belonged, at least for me. Then we moved to an even smaller town called Cape Girardeau, Missouri, as I was entering high school, and 30,000 people, very few Latinos, a lot of questions, you know, a lot of folks confused that I wasn't Mexican, a lot of folks confused that I was born here and all this other stuff. And it really defined me. It defined who I was. Now, I think about it now. I had a foundation, though. I had a foundation where I understood that there were places in this country, in this world, that I actually belonged as part of my identity. It wasn't abnormal to be Latino. And when I came to Kansas City, I finally started meeting other young Latino professionals. It was a great organization. Met folks there. Started getting involved with other organizations like the National Society of Hispanic MBAs. And I found my way back to my community. And I found my way back to this thing that I recognized I had been missing since I left Miami. And so for me, a lot of the work that I do today is driven based on this fact that I don't want other young people to experience that. I don't want other young Latinos that are in classrooms to feel like they don't belong. I don't want them to feel like they're different in any way, shape, or form. And I want them to understand that their cultural inheritance, that is all valuable and will make the difference in the long term. And so part of it, I'm just really healing my inner child. And part of it is understanding that, like, we need strong representation, because if not, who else is going to combat these narratives that exist around our community? Who else is going to be able to shine the way forward for our community? And who else is going to be able to say, hey, our community matters and we should treat it as such?
Well, do you feel like today you belong in Kansas City, even when you're not with other Latinos?
Really asking the difficult questions, Joetta.
Is that a tough question? Should I not ask that?
No. It's a really difficult question, because I think that belonging is such an interesting concept.
Well, let me give you some context for it, because I'm Filipino-American, and I certainly belong to the Filipino-American community here in the DC area, but I also feel like I belong in Alexandria as an Alexandrian, regardless of race or ethnicity. And I think it's tragic to only feel like you belong when you're with other people your race, because I don't think that does our communities any good either, to feel like we have to be in segregated communities.
I agree. I think in respect to the question around Kansas City, I'm definitely a Kansas Cityan.
Yeah.
If anything, I'm Midwestern in my values and my approach. And I've learned that being surrounded by East Coasters and folks from the West Coast and whatnot. I'm like, I definitely have Midwestern values here in terms of pace of life, in terms of how I approach the world, and in terms of my own adaptability and flexibility. And so definitely there. I think what's really interesting about it is that sometimes you got to learn to belong to yourself. If you can belong to yourself, you can belong anywhere. And that's been really kind of an inspiring and driving thing recently for me. When we're creating spaces of belonging, they have to be co-created. They have to be created with our community, not for our community. We also have to think about how does this sacred space that we created actually help support you in environments that aren't that sacred and or safe. And I think that that's part of the journey. If you can return home, so to speak, if you come back to a place that affirms your identity and who you are and values you in that way, maybe when you're released into the broader world, you can retain some of that affirmation and some of that confidence, and you can persist in a world that sometimes may not want you to persist. And I think that that's the important part. And so for me, I'm a reflective person. I take my work seriously and I take these concepts seriously. And there are days that I don't feel like I belong anywhere. And there are days that I understand that I am part of a larger, more beautiful community, and that even though I may deny it sometimes, I am definitely a Kansas Cityan, right? I am definitely somebody from the state of Missouri. I am definitely somebody who has seen the world differently and experienced different things. And so it is something that as I grow older, I get more comfortable with who I am. And I also understand the importance of having broader identities.
And multiple identities.
Absolutely. You know, I'm also a dad. I'm a husband. I'm a nonprofit leader. I am a fundraiser, but I also love the national park system. Like, I love being outdoors. And so I'm also learning that there are other communities there that I can participate in and engage with that aren't just solely about my ethnic identity. And I think that that's been really cool. The system sometimes will push you to just be one thing. And I think a really wonderful act of resistance is to say, hey, I am multiple things and I can exist in multiple spaces as a whole person.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to ask you about one more of your programs. I wish we had time to dive into all of them, but I want to ask you about your Futuros program. Tell us about that.
So we have a goal at LEC that by 2027, we will have added 50 new Latino educators into our Greater Kansas City community. And so we are in our third year of the Futuros program. We are on track and on target to ensure that we're bringing in 50 new Latino educators. And that is our contribution in increasing the representation of Latino educators, but also doubling down on the idea that it matters for us to have Latino educators across our community.
Edgar, how many Latino educators already exist in Kansas?
When we did our initial research back in 2021, we discovered that only 1% of educators are Latino in Kansas City. That amounted to 261 Latino educators.
Okay.
In comparison, there are 52,000 Latino students in the greater Kansas City area. That number is creeping up. We're closer to 2% these days than we were, but 2% is still roughly somewhere in the low 300s. And so there's more work to do there.
Right. So if you add another 50, then that will make a dent.
It will make a huge dent. I know that we have some funders and some folks that say we should bring 100, we should bring 150, we should work towards those goals. But when you're tackling a quarter of the current population, then that's a pretty meaningful goal.
Edgar, you just rattled off some numbers. On the website, you can download research that you've authored. Are you doing the research yourself, and why is it important?
We are actually partnering with the University of Missouri, Kansas City to do the research in terms of demographic data, in terms of quantitative and qualitative data around why Latino educators are leaving the profession or entering the profession. I think it's important that we root our case statement in actual data. I think it's important. And I think funders and supporters want to understand that it's not just a random idea that Edgar had, but it is an idea that's rooted in a problem that is well established. So that's one of the lessons that I learned early on in our work. People want evidence for why you exist. And whether that's fair or not is a whole different conversation. But the reality is, I don't think we would be where we are today as an organization if we didn't have establishing data for why we exist as an organization. Also, it's important to measure, right? At some point, we will do another report to see like what the populations are, how they've grown, how they've not grown, and then figure out like what a part of that can we attribute to our existence and our own impact as an organization. And so I think research is critical. I'm learning, though, that it isn't just the quantitative that matters. It is also the qualitative. And this is where the stories are so meaningful, right? Because now we have a collection of lived experiences that, you know, maybe one day we'll write autoethnographies or something like that. But like, it's all there. And so at some point, we'll get to the fact of like really digging in deeper on those stories and seeing like what stories we're able to tell because of them in the future.
Edgar, before we close, I've got one more question for you. This is a tough environment for programs like yours right now, politically.
Yes.
Everything is against you, it feels like, some days, I bet. How do you persist in this environment?
I don't think we have another choice.
Yeah.
I will say that the environment doesn't feel entirely too different than it was just a couple of years ago. I think the issues that we face are issues that have been long established within our country's history. They feel a little bit more prominent today and they feel a little bit more in your face. But I think the people who didn't believe in diversity, equity, and inclusion today didn't believe about it 3 years ago, right?
That's true.
I think funders are always looking for reasons to like fund new ideas and to fund different work and to like create new programs and stuff like that. And so that's just a natural part of being a nonprofit organization. And I think we have a responsibility. We are not an organization that receives federal dollars or state level dollars. And so we have a little bit more flexibility with what we say and what we do. And I'm actually really excited about that because I think in this moment, it's critical for organizations like ours to take a stance to the fullest extent of the law. But this isn't even about legality. This is about ethics and morality. If there are narratives about our community that need to be addressed, I am hopeful that our organization can take a stand on behalf of our community to say like, no, we're not going to tolerate that kind of behavior. I was talking about this with somebody yesterday. I get a little agitated about this as well. You know, at some point we lost the narrative around DEI. And somebody said that diversity, equity, and inclusion wasn't a good thing and was the bad thing. And I am confused as to how we got here, where we're looking at our websites, where we're removing language, where we're, you know, making sure that we're polishing our words and our language in order to continue to receive funding. My question is, at what point does racism become bad? Like, at what point are we like fighting against these other issues that are more harmful to our community than the ones that are being kind of pushed upon in this moment? And so if I get to do more work, and if I get another 5, 10, 15, heck, if I get another year at doing this work, then I'm hopeful that the work that we did was not just in spite of the current system, but in support of a new future where it is not weird to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion from a place of positivity and joy. That's what I'm looking forward to. And so the fact that I have the opportunity to do that and the fact that our organization can do something about that makes me proud in this moment. And what else is there to do? These people will exist and they will continue to exist. And it's our responsibility to offer a different alternative and a different perspective.
Edgar, it is clear that you fight for your teachers, that you fight for your students every day. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Please come back in the future and report on your progress.
Absolutely, Joanna. This has been a pleasure. I thank you so much for taking the time to highlight organizations like ours, and I really have enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening to Associations Thrive. We're so glad to have you here. You know, my personal mission and the mission of my company, Matrix Group International, is to help associations and nonprofits increase membership, generate revenue, and thrive in the digital space. I want to hear stories of how your organization is thriving in today's challenging landscape. Please apply to be on my show by going to podcast.matrixgroup.net. By the way, do you need help with a digital initiative? Maybe it's a website redesign, a new membership database, or a hybrid meeting that you're planning. I'd love to connect with you. Please visit the Matrix Group website at matrixgroup.net. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode of Associations Thrive. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, leave a 5-star rating, post a comment, and share it with your colleagues and friends. Bye.